Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The North Carolina legislature recently wrapped up their short session. They ended it after less than 7 weeks, and though it may have been short, legislators did a lot. With a supermajority in both chambers, Republicans overrode all of Governor Cooper's vetoes, of which there were many. They granted the towns in Mecklenburg County the right to start their own charter schools, revamped the way we elect judges, and passed a half dozen constitutional amendments that will appear on this fall's ballot. And they're coming back in November to deal with the outcome of that vote. And that just scratches the surface. To dig a little deeper and to examine how this sets the stage for the fall elections and the future of the state, we've invited two legislators and a legislative reporter to join us for the hour. State Senator Jeff Tarte, Republican from District 41 here in Mecklenburg County, is with us in our studio. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mike.
Good to see you again.
Pleasure to be here.
And with us by phone is Democratic State Representative Darren Jackson, the House Minority Leader representing District 39, which is Wake County. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. And from the studios of WUNC in Durham, Lauren Hirsch is with us. She's a legislative reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. Thank you for being here, Lauren.
No problem. Glad to be here, Mike.
Thank you. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. You can search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. While you can even watch the senator and I on Facebook Live this morning. Lauren, let me begin with you. How does what was accomplished in this short session, in terms of sheer numbers of material passed, laws, constitutional amendments, etc., compared to previous short sessions?
You know, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but they were able to manage a lot in a little time. Like you said, this was under 7 weeks. I think 6 weeks was the total amount done, but they were able to pass, you know, six constitutional amendments, which has been a high number. Usually we only see one or two. And they got the budget done in record speed, which the short session really is just to deal with the update of the two-year budget, which is $23 billion. And that was new this year, how they dealt with that. They did it in a conference report, which means instead of going through this long process, as some would say, you know, going through separate committees from each chamber, they just instead met behind closed doors, mostly Republican leaders, with some budget chairs to kind of discuss and negotiate that way, which then, you know, sped up the process, some would say. So that was really new. I'd say we saw hundreds of bills come through. Not all of them became law, but we did see just a lot. I can't even quantify it. I was going through, you know, every report I've done over the past 6 weeks, and I had probably 30 bills that we had reported on that just didn't even make it to the governor's desk.
The short session, the original purpose of the short session, as Lauren just said, is to adjust the budget every 2 years. And this year, as she said, Senator, the budget was adjusted in a different way behind closed doors in conference. If the purpose of the short session is to have the legislators come back to Raleigh and talk about the budget and fix the budget or adjust the budget, why do it behind closed doors? Why do it with very little Democratic input?
Sure. Great question. Actually, the budget doesn't get done in closed behind closed doors in secret meetings that you have to have the secret password.
Yeah, normally that's true, but everything I read this year about this says as it was. That's not true?
No. You got to have the whole story.
Okay.
And actually, most of the budget work, as you know, the short session, as Lauren pointed out, is to address any revisions to the budget based on revenue changes up or down and then allocating those or figuring out shortfalls. Actually, the budget work starts about 90 days, 3 months before we go back in session. So we were in committees and work groups and sessions throughout. And the budget, because of the size and enormity, we're dealing with a $23 billion budget across every aspect of state government. We're dividing that work up, if you will, as we go through to make those changes.
So let me hear from a Democrat who may feel shut out here. Is that your impression of the process, Representative Jackson?
Well, yes, we certainly felt shut out of the process. I've been here for five sessions or five terms now. I've been here when Democrats were in control, and I've been here under two different Republican speakers. And it was a lot different this time, and we did feel shut out. And even many other Republican members complained about being shut out on the House side. Of course, I can't speak for the Senate side, and because I wasn't involved in that. Mm-hmm. But it was not just Democrats, but also rank and file Republicans who complained about how the budget was put together this year.
Have you heard this before, Senator?
Sure. And to some extent, Representative Jackson's points are spot on, because the Democrats are pretty much left on the back bench during the construction of the budget process, unless they actively engage with majority members in both chambers. But the one thing that was different that made this happen faster, but also has inherent issues and problems, is that we put the budget forward not into conference committee, but mm-hmm. forwarded as a conference report, which makes amending it extremely difficult.
Yes. And that was deliberate, wasn't it?
It was.
Why?
To make the process move faster.
And not to lock out Democratic objections?
No, because it locks out Republican objections in certain areas, and it puts much more focus on the individual committees working on DHHS or working on transportation.
So, Lauren, I don't know how long you've been covering the legislature, but was this the way it was done when Democrats were in charge?
I've only been here one session, so I can't talk to previous sessions, but I do believe, you know, in previous sessions, you know, decades going back, members from both parties were allowed to amend the budget during the short session or to run amendments on the floor. So we definitely didn't see that. And I think, you know, as both lawmakers have said, mm-hmm. you know, there were some Republicans and there were some Democrats who did feel shut out. And so you did have to see a lot more, I would say, fixes or corrections later on in the session when we did get the technical corrections bill.
We focused on the budget a long time ago on this program. I guess at the beginning of the legislative session, we talked about this on the air. And since then, so many other things have happened that came out of that session. Would you say that the budget was the primary thing, or are there other things at the top of your list, Lauren, of the things that came out of this session that are more important than the budget?
The budget is very important just because that's how the state gets right. moving and going. But I would say one of the big issues that we will see definitely going into November are the 6 constitutional amendments that came out towards the end of session. And we knew these were coming. We were told, you know, early this year, you know, we might have them in January or March, that this was really just a waiting game for everyone, not just the reporters covering it, but also the lawmakers, you know, voting on these bills. So we do have 6 constitutional amendments that voters will be able to vote on in November. Those include one that would codify the right to hunt and fish into the Constitution, that would put a tax cap on income taxes, a voter ID, an update to judicial vacancies, and changing how the state elections board is appointed. And those are just a couple of them.
So from an outsider's point of view, it sounds like it was a very productive session. A lot of different things got done. From the Republican Party's point of view, would you say it was as productive as you wanted it to be? Could it have been more productive? Did it forward the ideas and the ideals of the party?
From my perspective, Mike, for me, this is my third term, so it's the third short session. The first two were a tremendous learning curve for me. And once you get inside the process, you realize the short session moves at a very different rhythm and pace than the long session. I would say for me, there was 44 initiatives that I worked on in this short session. Some started as long ago as 4 years. I had more things accomplished in this last 6 to 8 weeks than I have in the prior 4 years. And there's still many things to do.
And, of course, Democrats, Representative, are in the minority. How would you describe this session? Do you feel Democrats had any impact at all on what went on?
I think there were opportunities to have a little impact here and there. But overall, things were rushed, jammed down our throats, however you want to characterize it. And so, it would have been nice to have more time to debate the constitutional amendments. I think in the past when we've seen constitutional amendments, we've also had, for the most part, the enabling legislation that would go along with those constitutional amendments, so voters would know exactly what they were voting right. for and what the General Assembly intended to do if those things passed. We don't have that this time. And I think that's a big missing link that voters will have to take a kind of leap of faith in November when they vote. And I would have liked to see us spend more time on that, especially in light of the fact that we actually came back in session in January to do constitutional amendments. That's what we were told we were coming back to do. We were actually in session January and early February for 35 days and didn't pass a single bill. And then we passed, we passed the budget and six constitutional amendments in about 14 legislative days.
This may sound like a stupid question, and I hope it is not, but you are the House Minority Leader. When you're in the minority and the Republican Party, the opposition party, has a supermajority, what is there to lead? What do you do?
Well, we try to get as much information to our members about what is going on, because so, especially in the short session, things move very, very quickly. And so we are trying to communicate not only with each other about what's going on, but also with our constituents, as well as different interest groups and things of that nature, to try to organize. And, there, for instance, on the constitutional amendments, I mean, there are a lot of members who have seen the voter ID issue for 4 to 6 years, members, and so they're very familiar with that. But then when you take something that's changing the Board of Elections and is based on two Supreme Court cases based in, the last 24 months, and you're trying to read through the lines and trying to see exactly what power this is taking from the governor and giving to the legislature, it just takes time to understand these bills and then to explain them to everybody and make sure everybody understands what it is exactly they're being asked to vote on.
In Charlotte, Lauren, we probably pay less attention than they do in Raleigh to the legislature, unless they're trying to mess with us, which they quite often have been doing of late. But from our point of view here, it didn't seem like a terribly controversial session for the most part. There were some controversial measures that were passed. But it has been described by some experts as being highly contentious. How would you describe it?
It was contentious, I think, in some points. I listened to a lot of the floor debate. There were a lot of tempers flaring, especially during those constitutional amendment debates. It really became kind of, I wouldn't say nitpicky, but it was, back and forth. Mm-hmm. And I think especially when you look at one bill we haven't talked about, the Farm Act, the 2018 Farm Act, that was a really heated debate from both sides.
And that's the act that deals with whether or not outsiders can complain about the smells being emitted by certain large producers of, pork products, farm animals.
Yeah, that's, boiling it down, it's that. But it changes the state's nuisance laws. So you can't file a nuisance lawsuit if certain, accepted agriculture practices are happening at said hog farm or any other agricultural.
And a lot of the proposals seem to be put forth toward the very end of the session. Is that because this is stuff that the party in power wants to make sure it gets through, and they don't want to have a lot of debate on it, and maybe don't want a lot of sunlight shown on it? Why does a lot of stuff happen at the very end, Senator?
Well, some of it is the length and complexity and still trying to go through final revisions of bills. Farm Act is a good example of that. The constitutional amendments, a little bit of inside baseball. As Representative Jackson mentioned, we put forward, and a comment you made in opening, just so we clear a nuance, when you stated we passed a half a dozen constitutional amendments, we actually didn't. What we did is propose and put them on the ballot,
yes,
for others. And I think Representative makes a big comment because it's going to be hard for the voters to understand, and that's a concern.
Okay, and we'll talk about that, and we're going to come back and talk specifically about the budget, and we will get to all of those constitutional amendments as well as we go through the hour. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the recent short session of the legislature, which accomplished a lot, passed the budget, adjusted the budget, I should say, put six constitutional amendments on the ballot that we will vote on this fall, among other things. Senator Jeff Tarte, Republican from District 41 in Mecklenburg County, is with us in our studio. Representative Darren Jackson, the House Minority Leader, a Democrat from Wake County, is with us by phone. And Lauren Horsch, legislative reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer, is with us from WUNC in Chapel Hill. You wanted to expand a little bit on the question I asked just before the break, Senator, about why so many things seem to be crammed into the last couple of days or last week of the legislative session.
Yes, and the very last thing was the constitutional amendments. Mm-hmm. And there's some kind of inside baseball to understand procedurally how you pass those. Based on the day they're passed is the sequence they actually will appear on the ballot.
So the first bill that was passed, or the first amendment that was passed, will be first on the ballot?
Under the constitutional components at the end of the ballot, which is will be on hunting and fishing. You try to do something that's popular to the vast majority of the state. The very last item that should appear on the ballot will be your voter ID bill. And the idea is to pull people through the entire ballot because that's deemed to be pretty important.
Maybe that's the idea, but won't that give them voter fatigue by the time you get to the last item? Won't we just say, oh, what the heck, I'll do it?
Well, I think the thing that I understand with the 2018 November election, it's a blue moon year. So there's really no statewide elections. There's a few judges, but your congressional race is the highest race. So it'll be also an intent to try to draw more voters to encourage them to come out.
So let's start with the budget and what happens surrounding it. It includes pay raises for teachers about 6.5%. Highway patrol officers will see an 8% rise on average. And the budget includes raises of about 2% for state employees. How much of that generosity has to do with the fact that this is an election year? And how much of it has to do with the fact that there's a great belief that pay raises were late in coming and highly necessary? And I'll start with you, Senator.
I think if you look at teacher pay particularly, it's something we've been focused on. I've been in the Senate 6 years. We've raised teacher pay every single year. So it's an ongoing commitment, and we're not done. It's going to need to increase because of where we are nationally. We started out at 48th when I came in, an average teacher pay. We're setting about 37th, indexed a little bit higher. Other states are not sitting still, so we've got lots to do.
The Democrats did complain, Representative Jackson, about being locked out of this process to a great degree. How do you feel about the raises that have been put forth for teachers and highway patrol officers and others?
Well, you know, as far as the teachers go, one of the complaints still remains is that we are doing these very uneven, in that teachers at certain levels are getting raises more substantial than other teachers, and you know, some teachers are getting raises as low as $300 or $400. And so, you know, I would personally rather see us go with across the board increase of at least a minimal amount for teachers, and make sure that everybody got at least a good raise. And then if there are gaps, like I know we went back a few years ago and addressed starting teacher pay because we weren't just attracting people in our universities to major in education and to enter the teaching field. And so that was important to get the starting pay up. But we have done that at the expense of our more experienced teachers, the teachers who act as the mentors, the teachers who are less likely to lead the profession and are sticking around, who have been in the system 20, 25 years. I just think that we need to do more for those teachers.
Governor Cooper vetoed the budget. I'm sure he did that to reflect the opinion of the majority of Democrats in the legislature. So why did he veto it? What was he against? And what do you folks think should have been in it that was not?
Well, the governor proposed, I believe, an 8% average teacher raise. So he had a much higher teacher raise overall, and his raise was better for a lot of our more veteran teachers. He had higher raises for corrections officers in that his raise was structured a little differently. It was 2% or $1,250, whichever was more, plus an additional $1,000. He had that same type of raise structure applying in our mental hospitals. So they were different, but overall, the governor was putting more money to state employee raises and more money to teacher pay raises.
Senator?
Yeah, the comment would be, and we all get part of our, I explain what we do as a legislature. We're the state United Way agency. We take in funds and donations. We call them taxes and fees. And then we're responsible for allocating them. The governor has a good heart. He's well-intentioned. But when I came in 6 years ago, we were running $2 billion annual deficits. We've changed things, got our fiscal house in order. We're running $200 to $300 million surpluses that allow us to allocate. The proposed governor's budget in 1 year took us immediately to a $600 million structural deficit. That's unprecedented.
Well, the governor's job, one of the few jobs the governor has left, evidently, is to propose a budget, which then the legislature can completely ignore at their own whim. And when somebody puts forth a budget, I don't care whether they're a Republican governor or a Democratic governor, it's the starting point of the negotiation. So is there anything in the Democratic governor's budget that made it through, that you saw as a starting point, or was it dead on arrival?
I wouldn't say dead on arrival. That's probably not a fair assessment, because I think a lot of the same programs and priorities are actually in the governor's proposal. Mm-hmm. You have to realize the budget's 90% done prior in the long session for 2 years, and we're making adjustments. And so is the governor.
Republicans seem to have been making hay while the sun shines. They were out of power for almost 100 years, and now that you've been in power since, I think it was, is it 2011? I think you've been doing a lot of things to change the state in fundamental ways, and you've also made things difficult for governors, including Pat McCrory, who was a Republican. You didn't make life terribly easy for him, but you seem to have really amped it up since Governor Cooper took office. Do you fear that this approach may have some unsavory implications down the road if Democrats come back into power in the legislature and there's a Republican in the governor's mansion?
A complete bottom line assessment? Absolutely.
Is this a wise thing then to do?
And completely how we're doing it? Absolutely not. But there's a lot being accomplished. I'm kind of the mindset, you know, you open it up, you make it transparent, you let everybody participate. You've got the votes to pass whatever you need to pass. The Democrats, it doesn't really matter. Good ideas come from either side of the aisle.
Are they heard?
You'd be surprised. Probably 80, 85% of everything that's passed in a session is bipartisan. People don't recognize that.
Would you agree with that assessment, Representative Jackson?
Well, you know, there was a time that I would have agreed with that. However, I was struck, especially in the short session this year, looking at our bills. You know, every day we have a daily calendar, and there would be 20 bills on there, bills that were introduced, and almost all would be all Republican sponsors, or they would be all Democratic sponsors. Not a lot of bipartisan bills introduced this session, and so that trend is something I think we have seen the last several years. When I first began at the General Assembly, you know, we were told if we wanted our bill to move that we really needed to find a Republican to be on the bill. And that was a way to make...
But wouldn't that have been the same had you been there when the Democrats were in charge? Wouldn't Republicans have had to find a Democrat to be on
the bill? No. So that when I first entered, Democrats were in charge.
Okay,
and,
I'm sorry.
And the speaker at the time, Joe Hackney, insisted that we try to at least find a Republican co-sponsor on a bill, because if you could say it was bipartisan, the bill was just going to have a much easier, it was just going to have a much easier path to get through the chambers. Now you're seeing more, we had a school safety committee, as you're aware, that met throughout the spring, and it was a big deal in the House of how bipartisan that was going to be. Well, every bill that came out of that school safety was exclusively sponsored by Republican members with no Democratic members asked to be on the bill. And unfortunately, that's just a trend that we have seen the last several sessions.
I was just going to say the interesting thing, this budget in the short session was passed in a bipartisan. There was Democrats that voted for it. Interestingly, there were Republicans that voted against it.
Yeah. One of the things that I've read, Lauren, and maybe this is not true from your point of view, but some of the people say that one of the causes for this frenetic session, with so many things being crammed into it and passed out as a result of it, that our elections are coming up and that this could be a good year for Democrats. Is that really a possibility? Could Democrats win back control of either of branches, of either house of the legislature? or at least stamp out the supermajority?
You know, I'm not quite sure yet. I mean, I think, you know, you're going to see a lot of movement around Democratic candidates. There are a lot of people in the state who are not happy with the way, you know, things are going at the General Assembly. But, you know, we always say, you know, it'll come down to turnout. And I think that's correct. It's hard to say we might see a breakdown of the supermajority, but again, it's just hard to tell. But I think there will be a lot of movement. I haven't seen the internal polling from either the Republicans or the Democrats in the state, but I think they're going to put up a good fight.
And there will be six constitutional amendments that voters will decide on in the November election. Is that a large number of amendments in an average year of amendments? How often do we have constitutional amendments to vote on?
I'm not sure how often, but I do know this is a very large number. I think the last time we had, you know, this many constitutional amendments was, you know, back when I think we revised the Constitution. So this is, you know, highly unusual. Usually you see like one or two. And I think it'll be especially confusing because we don't have, you know, something next to it saying, you know, vote for Prop 1, mm-hmm. vote for Prop 2. We will have the Secretary of State, Elaine Marshall, and the Attorney General, Josh Stein, along with the Legislative Services Officer, Paul Coble, kind of set up, you know, a wording for what these are. So it's kind of like when you see a bill, you have the short title and the long title. So those will hopefully explain a little bit more what those constitutional amendments are. But, you know, it'll be confusing for voters, I think, and it'll be hard to rally around those. You know, you're going to end up having to say, you know, vote for all or vote for none.
Is the amendment approach, the approach that Republicans have taken here by proposing six constitutional amendments, a way to, I don't want to say to get around the courts, but eliminate the courts is the way to say it, because if it's an amendment to the Constitution and it passes, that changes the equation. Is this a new strategy for Republicans?
I would think it will engage the judiciary more because their responsibility is then to interpret the constitutionality of actions. Take the hunting, fishing. I have qualms. And does it now pit your constitutional right? Does that override personal property rights? So I decide you've posted no hunting and I'm going to hunt on your farm.
But the most contentious one is going to be voter ID. And voter ID has tentacles that go out into all different areas. And if you put it in the Constitution, if voters come back and say, yes, we agree, you should have to present a photo ID at the polling place, it makes it more difficult to challenge that once it's in the Constitution, doesn't it?
Well, one thing with voter ID, I actually think it's not very constitutional. Over 70% of folks agree with it. There's six Democrat states that have photo ID. 39 states have voter ID. Mm-hmm. The ruling by the Fourth Appellate Court, which is ruling the 16-1468, which is where the precision, surgical precision that we did dealt with and ruled unconstitutional. All the items that the Fourth Appellate Court ruled applied to the election laws. They said nothing was unconstitutional relative to voter ID. 6 years ago, I filed a voter ID co-sponsored with two African-American Democrat senators that filed it.
Let's talk about these amendments. There's an amendment, as we just talked about, to require photo ID at the polls, an amendment protecting the right to hunt and fish, which will be first on the ballot, an amendment defining crime victims' rights, an amendment to remove the governor's power to appoint members of the State Board of Elections and Ethics Enforcement, an amendment to cap income taxes at 5.5%, and an amendment that would remove the governor's power to fill judicial vacancies and give that power to the legislature. So, Representative Jackson, I know Democrats probably don't like some of these, maybe all of them. Why?
Well, you know, again, it's been said the devil is always in the details, and here we don't really have a lot of details as far as how are these things going to work. And so you just kind of sometimes you just have to assume that you know, the Republicans don't have the best of intentions on some of these based on some of the problems and issues that the two branches of government have had. And it does appear that the Board of Elections amendment and the Judicial Selection Amendment are clearly power grabs to take power away from the executive branch and give it to the legislative branch.
But by putting these, what you characterized as power grabs, into the hands of voters, letting them make the decision, since you're the party out of power and had the legislature decided to do this on their own, there may have been challenges to it, but they could have had they could have done it. This way, you're putting it in the hands of voters. Isn't that a gift to you and the Democrats?
Well, they tried, you know, the Board of Elections, they tried to do it through statute, and the court said no. The courts ruled that they could not do it that way. And so, and as far as judicial selection, you know, the governor's power to appoint is in the Constitution for the appellate courts and the Superior Court. And so any change that they wanted to make to that had to go to the people through a constitutional amendment. I don't think the Republicans are doing it out of goodness of their heart. They're doing what they have to do in order to make these changes.
And the governor says that these amendments are confusingly worded, but it's my understanding that something called the Constitutional Amendments Publication Commission has yet to draft the language that will appear on the ballot. So is it Democrats' fear that these amendments will be worded in such a way that voters will not understand what they're voting for or against?
Yes, and that is the fear. I mean, the wording that will appear on the ballot is in the statutes that were passed, in the bills that were passed about each amendment. There will be a caption. I think it's estimated to be 5 to 10 words that a committee will have to agree on to put on the ballot. But, you know, the wording of the amendment has already been decided by the General Assembly.
Senator?
Mike, one comment about the judicial selection, a couple points of clarification. First, it's for vacant positions only, which usually happen, usually either death or retirement. They're only for the period until the election, so you don't fill the completion of a judge's term. And what you have currently is a governor. So if I was governor, I actually think changing this would be a good idea as a governor, because you were making one person solely responsible with no input required from anybody. And I could put my son on, who works in telco and has no background in law, but legally could sit somebody. But here's the other thing that changes. It allows citizens to make formal recommendations. It allows a bipartisan commission to put forward recommendations and nominees. It allows the state Supreme Court to have input. It allows both the House chamber and the Senate. And then based on all of those, they put forward recommendations that the governor makes the final selection between two candidates based on that. Now, should it be more? Maybe.
But couldn't it be argued that the governor is one of the few statewide elected officials and therefore would be more qualified or be more representative of the people and have more at stake than individual legislators would have by making these appointments?
Absolutely not. You have one person versus probably over 200 people will have an input to guide and give information to the governor now.
Right, we have to take a break. That's Senator Jeff Tartt, Republican from Mecklenburg County, Representative Darren Jackson, Democrat from Wake, and Lauren Horsch with the Raleigh News and Observer. We're coming right back. The polls are open for WFAE's FAQ City podcast. Which question should be answered next? Are people actually filling up all the new apartments in town? How clean are the region's rivers and lakes? Who is the Jesus Saves guy in Uptown? Cast your vote on WFAE.org. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the legislative short session that recently ended and what was accomplished, and we're getting several points of view on this. Senator Jeff Tartt is with us, Republican from Mecklenburg County, Representative Darren Jackson, Democrat from Wake County and the House Minority Leader, and Lauren Horsch, a legislative reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. The state income tax now is, I believe, at it tops out at 5.499%, and you want it capped through this legislation that passed this session at 5.5%. Unlike the federal government, states cannot print money, and so you got to have a balanced budget. Otherwise, you'll go into deficit spending, and that causes all kinds of problems. So if you have a permanent cap on how far we can raise taxes, what happens if things go south? What happens if suddenly we need to spend a lot of money on bridges and roads and schools, etc.?
Well, first, there's provisions that allow you to pull those funds and raise taxes. And this provision only applies to income taxes. So you have to realize there's over 18 ways we tax and charge fees to people in the state. So you're only looking at one aspect. And what has been the shift is moving from income tax structures to consumption-based taxes. So that doesn't prevent any of that.
And this would be a constitutional amendment. So to go beyond 5.5%, if this passes, would be difficult, wouldn't it?
It would be a challenge, no question.
And that's purposeful.
It is, indeed.
How do the Democrats feel about that, Representative?
Well, Mike, actually, it's not going to be 5.5%. The constitutional amendment is going to be 7%.
Where did I get that figure? Where did I get 5%?
Well, that's what the Senate, that is the number that had passed over from the Senate.
Okay.
But luckily, the Democratic caucus was able to stay unified against this, along with some more moderate Republicans in the House, and they were able to stay strong against it until there was a compromise reached of making it 7%.
Okay.
So still, in my opinion, it's not necessary, and I do worry about all the things you just talked about, because, you know, I think we can all agree that sales tax is the most progressive form of tax that we do have. And, you know, when we talk about caps, we're not talking about caps necessarily just on everybody. I mean, this prevents us from having more of a graduated tax code if we needed to have, you know, if we had to raise it in a recession. And so if we needed to raise it from those who could most afford it, from, you know, millionaires and people who used to pay a higher tax rate than 7%, this would leave us with no options other than the sales tax. And that's, you know, very regressive. It hits our lowest income residents the hardest. And it's not the way I think we need to tie our hands in the case of a recession.
Senator.
Well, there's things where we still need to get our own house in order. One example of that is on collections of the excise tax. I discovered this session working with folks at the Department of Revenue. We bill about $1.5 billion. We write off bad debt, $500 million every year. If we just go collect two-thirds of that, think about that being expended and available for teacher pay.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because I think it's people's heads will explode, but the Hunting and Fishing Rights Amendment, which is the first amendment on the ballot, it actually shocks me that we're going to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot that enshrines in the Constitution the right to hunt and fish. Why is that needed?
That one you're going to have to ask somebody who is massively supportive. I've grown up hunting and fishing my whole life.
Right.
I think the Second Amendment more than protects that in individual.
So, Lauren, what was the justification given on the floor for the need for this amendment?
There were a lot of people, not just on the floor, but also in committee meetings, that did say that, you know, our Second Amendment rights, you know, and our right to go out and hunt and fish were under attack, and, you know, a lot of us couldn't.
But no one has ever advocated outlawing fishing rods.
Yes, that would, to my knowledge, that is correct. I have yet to see that bill pop up.
My dad used to whack me with one.
Well, yes.
I'm sure it was necessary.
Indeed.
Go ahead, Lauren. I'm sorry.
But yeah, no, I just, you know, there hasn't been, you know, we've heard time and time again that, you know, these rights are under attack, but there hasn't, to my knowledge, or that I've been able to find, you know, there haven't been bills outlawing, you know, hunting by traditional methods. And there's just a lot of other concerns.
So is the hunting and fishing part of this really based on the hunting part of this and focus more toward the right to carry a firearm? And Representative Jackson, do Democrats see this as a way Republicans can throw red meat to the base?
Yeah, I mean, it was something that, of course, that has been pushed for several sessions. So I would not characterize it as being something that the Republicans wanted to put on the ballot just this year because of turnout or anything like that. Mm-hmm. This is something that I believe the Senate has pushed for several sessions now. It is something that I believe that is unnecessary. One of the concerns that was raised in the House about this bill is Sunday hunting. Currently, we have some prohibitions in some counties about Sunday hunting, if it's allowed, at what times, how close to churches, and things of that nature. And there was the concern from legislative staff that passage of this amendment might invalidate some of those prohibitions. And so me representing a urban county like I do, that was one of the reasons that I voted against the bill, against the amendment, putting it forth to the voters. But, you know, I do expect it'll pass. We do have a hunting and fishing culture. I do not believe it's under attack, but I also don't believe it'll be harmed by passing this amendment.
So that's first on the ballot. Last on the ballot will be the voter ID. And, Lauren, this is a very favorable issue for hardline Republicans. A lot of hardline Democrats find this very distasteful and hate the idea of voter ID. Where do you think most North Carolinians will come down on this?
That's hard to tell right now. We, you know, people have said that polling shows that North Carolinians favor, you know, voter ID or being able to present a voter ID. But you never know what is going to happen at the ballot box. So we really well could see this, you know, go through just because I think it's something like 66% of voters approve of a voter ID. And I mean, polling can go either way based upon how you word the question. So it'll, you know, we really could see it pass. But I think there's going to be a lot of people out campaigning against it because there are concerns about how it could potentially disenfranchise low-income voters or voters of color who don't necessarily have access.
Well,
or
the federal court struck down the 2013 North Carolina law that included the voter ID provision. And that law was struck down because they said it targeted African-Americans with almost surgical precision, which you referenced earlier, Senator. But studies show that the need to produce a photo ID does hurt lower income people, and particularly African Americans, the hardest. Is this a way to get around the courts?
Absolutely not. And actually, if you go back again to the Fourth Appellate Court, it didn't rule unconstitutional voter ID at all. What it did with the surgical
precision. But aren't you targeting with surgical precision people who are already hurt by that?
Absolutely not. That reference and that opinion of the courts pertained to some of the election laws, and particularly because absentee ballots weren't addressed, had nothing to do with voter ID.
Okay.
Well, I would disagree with that. And in fact, the court actually pointed out that the fact that the photo ID requirement was required only for in-person voting and not for absentee ballots, where the greatest percentage of fraud occurs. They said that the voter ID provision was both too broad and that it would impact minorities, older people, younger people, poor people, and was not broad enough, and that it wouldn't stop voter fraud through absentee ballots. So the court certainly did strike down the voter ID thing, and the court did that on a basis of looking at everything and saying that although they were not saying it was racism or racial motivation, but it was certainly a political motivation that believing that these types of bills target Democrats because African Americans vote in large block for the Democratic Party. And so the court has said you couldn't do that. That is now the law of the Fourth Circuit recovers us. The hope is by the Republicans that if we pass this amendment and that the people of the state demand a voter ID in their constitution, that they can then go back to with the same exact bill and say, okay, now our motivations are not to hurt one particular political group or one racial minority or anything like that. Our motivation is to do what our people told us and put it in the state constitution. And so that is why the real concern is why is there no enabling legislation? Why can't we see? Are we going to expand some of the things the court mentioned in its opinion? Are we going to do like other states and allow college IDs, public assistance IDs, employer IDs, or are we only going to require North Carolina real IDs?
And the answer to that, Senator, would be why? Why haven't we seen some of this going into the amendment?
Some of it is already. There's things in that amendment that address which IDs will be pertinent.
I mean, I know as a Republican you're going to deny all the suspicions that people have about motivation here.
Sure.
But what is the motivation? Why do we need it?
Well, one, for voter ID, it's like anything else. You need to be a legitimate voter, registered. And that's one of the ways to demonstrate
it. But everybody gets a voter card. I have one in my wallet right now. Why can't you just
show
that?
Not required. Voter card potentially would be fine. It's used in a lot of states, but there needs to be
some
kind of
ID. But there's been no real evidence of any kind of voter fraud anywhere in the country.
I don't think, personally, voter fraud's the real issue. Even though there's some, but it's not, it's negligible, because I think all of our elections are fair. But what it does do is helps the process. I had voters last time walked in, a person in front of me went in, and they said, "Sorry, sir, you can't vote. You already voted." He says, "What do you mean?" And they showed him the rules. And it was, he was senior, and junior had voted. They'd marked the wrong one. It will help clarify matters like that. Provisional ballots will be cleaner and easier. So that's why you do voter ID.
Okay, so we have people here on the panel that are affected by another decision by the legislature, and that was to allow Mecklenburg County towns to have charter schools. You're the senator from Mecklenburg County. I believe this also affects, to a certain degree, Wake County, and Representative Jackson is from Wake County. This was a measure put forth by Representative Bill Brawley from Union County, which will allow the town of Matthews to have their own charter schools. And some people believe this is the slippery slope to the ending of support for public education. How do Democrats see this?
Well, I think that is an accurate assessment of what the worst case scenario would be. We just see it more a danger that we're going to have more segregation in our schools.
So why is this a good idea, Senator?
I personally don't believe it is a good
idea.
Okay,
Senator, why do you think it's a good idea? Why do Republicans think it's a good idea?
Well, first of all, the four towns in Mecklenburg had formal requests from their town boards to do this. Three of them by actual votes, one by just direct contact being Mint Hill. And it's really just a funding alternative source that we gave authority to those communities, because in the last CMS bond that we did for our schools, it was almost $900 million. Yet the schools and where a lot of the growth, there's no money for them for the next 5 to 10 years. So it gives them a capital raise alternative.
Has there been discussion elsewhere in the counties not affected by this, Lauren, about this provision now?
I think there's been a lot of discussion around, you know, just I would say here in, you know, the Triangle, just because this could have statewide implications if this happens in Mecklenburg. You know, why can't, you know, counties like Durham or Wake or Orange go ahead and say, oh, well, we don't think our issues are being addressed by the school system. You know, we think there's overcrowding. You know, why don't we do something similar? So I think there could be eventual statewide implications, even though this is a local bill that only impacts these four towns in Mecklenburg County.
I think I may have misspoken a moment ago. I think Bill Brawley is from Mecklenburg County.
He is.
And not Union
County.
The legislature also changed how judicial electoral districts in both Wake and Mecklenburg counties are drawn. No Democrats voted for this bill, which would split Mecklenburg County's 21 districts, court seats among 8 districts and create identical Superior Court districts. Why did all the Democrats say no to this? Representative.
Oh, Reverend, thank you. Well, you know, I don't think we got to be involved in the drawing of the districts is one thing. The second thing is, I mean, on the district court level, there just was no need for it. I understand that in Mecklenburg County, their Superior Court judges had a big population deviation, which was an issue in a lawsuit in Wake County several years ago. And so I understand that there was a thought that they needed to do something about the Superior Court, but there was no problem with the district court.
And we have about 90 seconds left. So, Senator, this was your bill. You say creating fewer districts will allow voters to make more informed decisions. How so?
Well, the Superior Court, first, let me say that it was a disenfranchisement of voters because we had different populations that varied as much as 300,000 population. Wake solved it. We fixed it because it was unconstitutional. Even the Senate minority leader said so. The district court is a lower court than the Superior Court and should represent a fewer people. It had countywide 1 million people where the Superior Courts were in election at 300. That's wrong. It needed to be fixed.
In addition to your bill, the legislature already shrunk the State Court of Appeals, put party labels on judicial races, eliminated public financing for court elections, done away with this year's judicial primaries, and you've discussed appointing rather than electing judges. One national analyst says that nowhere in America were so many changes coming to courts in such a relatively short period of time. Why all this mucking with the courts?
Well, one is, let me clarify the one point saying that we would want to appoint all the judges. Absolutely not. And I personally would be totally against any measure that would do that. We need to be electing our judges and keep a degree of separation between the three branches of government.
Finally, you also wrote a key amendment to a bill which would have provided funding for a buyout or changes to the I-77 toll lanes. That bill died. Does that put the period on the sentence? Are we done with that issue?
Absolutely not done. What it did, at the request of the head of the I-77 business plan, working with the NCDOT director, they did not want the bill passed. That's why we killed it rather than come to a compromise, so they have more flexibility on how we would fund the cancellation.
Senator Jeff Tart, Republican from District 41, Mecklenburg County, Representative Darren Jackson, House Minority Leader from Wake County, District 39, and Lauren Horsch, legislative reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. Thank you for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.